This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at Reach 2022, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders Educational Programs on March 24 and 25, 2022, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
I used to have a license plate that said, just the random one given to me, said IRS on it. And then three numbers. I always thought that was appropriate, but I'm not with the IRS. I try to keep people from getting in trouble with the IRS. So I'm not sure why anyone would go to a session called compliance, but I'm hoping that my theory is that if you're here, it means you're really in compliance, and so this is going to be just a pat on the back. I want to try to focus... do two things. First, I want to go very high level. Is who here has an organization that's, say, within the last 2 years started? Okay. So very high level. I'll probably move through fairly quickly on this. Just some of the simple things from a compliance standpoint, who you need to be compliant with. And then towards kind of the second third, I'm going to focus on diving deeper into some of the things where, as of late, it kind of seems to come in when it rains, it pours on different issues. But as of late, some of the things that we've been seeing people that we work with have been out of compliance. And then third, I'd like to save a decent amount of time at the end, hopefully, in order for you guys to be able to ask specific questions about compliance in your organizations. I don't know if anyone is brave enough to speak up, but it'd be interesting at the beginning. Does anybody have a nightmare scenario that your organization went through on compliance? Okay, good. That's a good place to start. So we talk about two basic levels. When we talk about compliance, the two kind of entry levels are your IRS, which is the most important in that they will shut you down faster than anybody else, and then your state level compliance. IRS compliance is, there's initial level of compliance, getting registered with them. There's an annual level of compliance, a 990. And then there's also compliance from the standpoint that the IRS can come and audit your nonprofit just like they audit individuals. I will say the bigger you are, the more likely you are to be audited. So the Christian Aid Ministries and the Anabaptist Financials of the world are much more likely to be audited than the smaller organizations. But we work with a small organization that has been audited as well, so it can happen. The way I like to tell people, if you're ready for this, then you're good. If you're ready for an audit from an IRS agent who is two things. One, a very smart individual, and obviously intelligence is going to fluctuate. And then, two, they hate Christians. If you can pass an IRS audit from that type of auditor, then you know you're in a good place from a compliance standpoint. So, very basic level, you're going to be... Are any of your organizations under a church? Okay. So, some of this talk, I'll try to split it out. Some of this talk will focus on everybody, and some will focus on those not under the church because it's a little different. So basic level, if you're not under a church, you're filing a 1023, you're getting a determination letter back from the IRS, and that can take a while. And then they are saying on there, do you need a 990? Yes or no? The 990 then is going to be due every single year. And it's at levels. It's called a postcard or a 990N for anything under $50,000. And then $200,000 or more in revenue, and you're moving to a 990EZ, which is a 990N is extremely simple, 10 minutes. And EZ is much more involved. And then the full 990 would be... at levels, let's see, above 500,000. So one thing I will make a note there that I think some ministries miss is you have to consider donated items, especially if you're running a clinic or books or something like that where you're getting a lot of donations in. Say CAM feeds a lot of organizations clinical stuff. If you're getting donated items in, you need to include that in your thresholds for filing. Okay, the second level. Hopefully everyone is there on that first level. I have seen an organization come to us where they just haven't filed in 3 years and they got revoked. We're currently just starting to work with an organization that it's been 5 years since they filed a 990. They changed addresses along the way, never got the who knows how many IRS letters, and they had lost status some time ago. And so that is a difficult situation. The original one I mentioned, it just scrapped and started over with a new organization. This one that's been for 5 years, they want to be careful because people have been giving during those 5 years, and basically they're giving to an organization that is not able to take charitable deductions or have a charitable deduction related to. So they're going back, and we're having to do 5 years of 990s to catch them up and then refile with the IRS. The next level, if you're at that place and you haven't done that, I would suggest you see Tyler Hosteller, and he does kind of a package for Anabaptist nonprofits to get people started. The next level is the state. So this would be, the church would be exempted from this, basically. So at the state level, it's registering one as a corporation or whatever, in nonprofit corporation in the state that you are in. However, and the bigger picture is, anywhere where you solicit or get funds from, you will need to look into their registration for that state. So there's about 40 out of the 50 states that require registration, and that can be a little overwhelming. So just for threshold purposes, I'll mention Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, at $25,000 nationwide income, you're required to register with Pennsylvania if you are soliciting or getting any funds from their state. At $100,000, your registration must include a compilation, which is compiled financial statements from a CPA. At $250,000, you're required to get a review, and at $700,000, you're required to get an audit. Those thresholds are different across the board, and there's exemptions in certain states for different types of organizations as well. What I would say there is, the more you can be prepared at the ground level, if your organization is not to that point, the better. What we've seen, it's a little more difficult to get caught by at the state level than at the federal level. But what we've seen basically is if the state catches you not having registered and you're soliciting, they'll basically can shut you down in that state. So it's not a nationwide thing. So for instance, an organization we started working with, and they had not registered for solicitation in a state that they held an auction in. And so that the state basically wanted them to cancel the auction until they were registered. And registration, depending on your size, because it requires a review, audit, or compilation in many cases, it takes some time to get there. So it's not like, hey, we need to register and you can be registered tomorrow. It could be months, and in some cases, more than a year to go through that process. The other situation I've seen was a state. So a registration had lapsed. A state called the nonprofit and just said, hey, we're just wondering, have you guys sent out any newsletters recently? I said, oh, yes, we sent out one in March or whatever it was. Okay, thank you. And they hung up. And then they busted them for solicitation afterwards. So as far as preparing for this, again, when you think about those levels, think about donated items is going to be included in that. As far as preparing for those thresholds, if you're not there, I would suggest two things. One is really make sure your chart of accounts is set up well to allow for proper presentation within your forms. So make sure you're separating program revenue from admin revenue from fundraising revenue at the minimum. And then if you're doing more than one programs, it's helpful to keep those separate as well. The other things I'll say that can become difficult, especially if you have an overseas presence, is your fixed assets. So think any building built or any vehicles bought. When that was done 10 years ago and now you're to the size that you need a review done, there could be some problems because that's a historical item sitting on your balance sheet. The CPA will need the support for those purchases. And keep in mind, for nonprofits, if you're building something that's often done with volunteer labor, the volunteer labor hours will need to be kept as well for those fixed assets, because you'll have to put an estimated value up for the building to include the volunteer labor. So again, been in situations you go overseas and you're like, all right, you have this building that was built 30 years ago. Like, what's the value? It's really hard. It's easier if you have the documentation. I will say, especially for smaller organizations, keeping up with all the state registrations and requirements, because they're all different. They call different things revenue. They have different thresholds, etc. It can be very challenging. I would suggest their Anabaptist Foundation, Mark Anthony Peachy would be the contact, and they provide that service to conservative Anabaptist organizations. There is some small fee involved, but that can be easier for smaller organizations to keep in compliance rather than trying to wade through it yourself. Okay. One other thing before we dive into some of the problems. Receipts. So I sometimes get questions on receipting. If you want good examples, there's something called the ECFA, which provides books and other guidance for receipts and the wording involved. But the basics is your receipt should have the names of both parties, the donor and the recipient, a date, an amount, and the statement, if true, that no goods or services were provided in exchange for this donation. Some common exceptions to that, which may not seem so obvious, is if you invite people to a banquet, if you hold a banquet and people give at the banquet, unless it's being paid for separately, meaning unless they pay for the banquet costs and then give, they would be receiving something in exchange for their donation and in the value of the banquet. Another thing would be an auction. If you guys have ever been to, say, the Haiti benefit auction, and on the receipt, if you notice, they say estimated value of whatever you bought. So, and then anything above that would be considered a donation. Any questions on that? Okay. Another thing I'll mention is with receipts is for goods or materials that are given, and that includes stock as well. You are not allowed by regulations to give a value. You have to assign a value internally, and they have to write it a value for their own taxes. But if someone donates something that's a good rather than cash or stock, you would write, you know, receipt of, you know, 1,000 books or receipt of this 1,000 shares of this stock, and that would be all they get in their receipt. It's up to them to give a value. But again, you'd have to assign a value yourself internally. One more thing from a compliance standpoint, especially as you grow and get to the point where you need a review and an audit, it's very important to get the cutoff correctly. And there's a cutoff in two areas. One is the calendar year end, and that's for your donor's sake. So, and the other is your fiscal year end. So around both those periods, so January, let's say you're a junior fiscal year end, January and July, you're going to want to keep receipts, or not receipts, but support that show the date of the checks written and the date of the envelope stamped. Both have to be prior to year end for it to be proper cutoff. Otherwise, it's considered to be a January gift rather than a December. So if you ever have somebody come in and ask you if they can backdate a date in January to December, the answer is no. It's pretty easy. Okay. All right, here's where we're going to get more into the weeds. This we have been seeing for a number of years, and it's just a little hard to get your head around, but when you have overseas missions, do any of you guys work with an organization that have overseas? Yes? Okay. Well, I'll try to go quickly through this then. For overseas ministries, you have to think about whether or not the overseas activity needs to be put into your organization's records. And there's two options. It can be a grant to that organization, or it can be that their expenditures are your expenditures. When we look at deciding that, if your board is their board, or they just have a rubber stamp board on in their country, then that's your organization. If you do have separate boards, then you have to have two things, and this would require either consolidation or at least giving details about them in a footnote. That would be control other than through the board, and so that could be basically like simplistic way to, like, can you tell them what programs to run, what programs to start, what programs to stop? If so, you probably have control. Or it could be that their board is a group from your management team. And then the other side is economic interest. And so I'll just read this definition from the accounting literature. Economic interest would be the entity holds or utilizes significant resources that must be used for the purposes of the not-for-profit, either directly or indirectly, by producing income or providing services. And the not-for-profit is responsible for the liability of the other entity. So if you're giving 50% of their support, it may be up in the air. If you're giving 90% or 100% of the support, that organization is probably you and would need to be included on your 990. Okay. All right, as far as if you are consolidating an overseas entity, you'll need to make sure the IRS, and this is a little silly, but the IRS will hold you to U.S. standards no matter where you are in the world. So if you guys are just U.S.-based or if you're overseas, you need to make sure you have support for all your transactions. That can be very challenging over in places like Haiti, where you don't have a lot of receipts giving. I know with Christianity Ministries, I'm sure they give you the form if you're interested. They take their own receipt book around, and so they write out receipts and have the vendor sign off. If you're giving grants, so say you're just a U.S.-based organization, but you give grants to other organizations, whether that be overseas or U.S.-based, you're responsible for the donations that come through you, just as if you're doing the programs yourself. So you're not going to get receipt-type information, but you're going to get some kind of feedback for the grants that you're giving. So that may look like, you know, calls that are documented from the other organization discussing how your funds were used, or that should also include some kind of record keeping reports that show here's how the money was spent, and here's basically giving enough detail to show that whatever donor stipulation you received from the donation were carried out by the other organization. Okay, one other thing I'll just quickly mention, because this is more overseas. The last thing, the consolidation, the church would not be involved in that, so you'd be exempt. I think the rest would be church or no church, it doesn't matter. So FBARs, if you have any overseas activity, just make sure that both the organization and the missionaries who have signing authority on any overseas bank accounts. You have to check the thresholds, but are required to fill out what's called an FBAR form. So it's often easier if there's one person in the organization that has that responsibility and can help all the missionaries, plus do the one for the organization. It's a money laundering thing from the government. Okay. And those are due same as taxes. Those are due every April 15th. The final thing I want to talk about, and this one is definitely one we see around, unfortunately. This is called excess benefit transactions. Is anybody here familiar with that terminology? It's probably a bad thing, but hopefully by the end of this you agree with me that you wish you had never heard of excess benefit transactions. So excess benefit transactions, the general term and the normal way they think about this, I would assume most of you guys would never see. And that's basically like there's the director of the organization wants to sell his car, it's worth $10,000. The board wants to say thank you for your work and give some $50,000 for a $10,000 value. So basically, someone at the management level or board level or family of those individuals or business owned by those individuals, someone is getting a benefit that is in excess of what they're giving to the organization. Hopefully, we would never see something like so blatant as that. However, what is much more likely to be seen is what's called an automatic excess benefit transaction. And I've got in the back, if anybody, when we talk about this, feels like it might be applicable to your organization, I've got a law article back there that it does a good job of summarizing it, kind of the layman's level. And then also at the back, I'll mention, if anybody is interested in the state registration from Anabaptist Foundation, I've got their forms back there talking about that. So an automatic excess benefit transaction is a valid payment. So it was validly given to the missionary or the employee or whoever it is. However, it did not run through payroll. So let's just talk about some of the examples of what that could be. One thing I've seen at a couple different clients is like at Christmas time, maybe a card and a gift card is given to all the employees. All that should always run through payroll. If you don't, it's a payroll issue, which to me is not the biggest thing in the world. However, if included in who gets that is the director or assistant director or somebody at the management level, and it's not run through payroll, you've now got an excess benefit transaction. Another thing that you might see is housing. So sometimes the director or somebody in management is required to be on site and live on site. That is fine. If it's for the benefit of the organization, that's fine. That's not a problem. However, if the organization, which this tends to happen too, has acquired some properties around the area, and just as a benefit to the individual gives free housing, that has to be run through payroll. If it doesn't, and it's a management level person, then or family member of management, that would be an excess benefit transaction. Another example would be a payment made. So say payment for rent or other personal expenses on behalf of an individual. So say the director's rent is paid directly from the organization and doesn't pass through the director, it needs to go on payroll, so that would be an excess benefit transaction. Another one that would be pretty common would be use of a vehicle. So I've seen a situation where a member of management was just given a vehicle and that did not run through payroll, that would be an excess benefit transaction. But probably the more common would be the mission has a vehicle and it's allowed to be used for personal use. And if that portion is not run through payroll, again, you've got an excess benefit transaction. Any other benefit, and if anybody can think of any they want to list out, any other benefit that does not run through payroll, you potentially have a problem. So I will jump down and then I'll go back about how to fix it, but I will jump down and say, why is this a big deal? Excess benefit transactions is a big deal. It's the only thing I know about where if you have one, the individual board members of your organization can be personally fined by the IRS. So your organization gets fined and your individual board members. So talking about some of the potential benefits or potential consequences of excess benefit transactions. It can be a 25% fine to a person receiving the benefit. So you have to pay back the benefit plus 25%. If it's not done timely, that goes to an additional 200% fine for the item. In addition, each board member or senior member of management who would have been involved in the decision to do this, give the car or whatever it is, can be individually fined 10% of the transaction. So if you give a $10,000 vehicle to the director, it's not properly run through payroll or that type of thing, potentially you could get to a situation where every single board member is paying $1,000 of their personal money. So here's the catch. If you're in a non-church situation, you would report this through your 990. If you're in a church situation, there's a separate form for it. But I'm just going to read you the question from the 990, and this will kind of highlight where the problem comes in. Did the organization engage in an excess benefit transaction with a disqualified person during the year? So if you've done this during the year and you're not reporting it, you're signing this 990. You'd be signing basically a lie that, hey, I know this, but I don't want to report it, so I'm just going to sign off and off we go. But here's where the much bigger problem comes in. Part B, is the organization aware that it engaged in an excess benefit transaction with a disqualified person, management, etc., in a prior year, and that the transaction has not been reported on any of the organization's prior form 990? So at this point, we're saying forever. So the only way around this, if you know it, and you basically the effect of it, if you know this in the past somewhere and you're not taking care of it, every single year you're making a false statement to the IRS by signing that 990. And you're asking your CPA, which we would not sign it, but you're asking your CPA to sign off a lie as well. However, so how can you fix it? You're just going to have giant fines, basically, if you did the true excess benefit transaction where you gave $50,000 for a $10,000 car. However, if you fall into the automatic excess benefit transaction, the good news is there is a way out of it. It's a little painful in some circumstances, but there is a way out. You have to fix it in order to keep from getting all the fines. You have to fix it contemporaneously. So, and then versus in the regular excess benefit transaction, you have to fix it that year or that 200% fine comes into play. For the automatic, you have to fix it contemporaneously. And it's going on to define contemporaneously meaning any time before the IRS catches you, basically. Any time before an IRS audit. So I actually had an organization recently correct one that had been going on for years. It was a tiny amount of gift cards given out to all the employees. From the payroll standpoint, we're like, fix this going forward and run it, make sure it runs through payroll. However, who are the people that are disqualified inside of your organization? So in their case, it was the director and assistant director. So for those two organizations, We went back for beyond the statute of limitations, and we said, let's calculate how much it is, and we're going to run it through your payroll in the current year. It's not perfect, but at least you're paying payroll taxes, income taxes on it, even though it's in the wrong year. And then we report. It's very simple. I'll hold it up so you guys can see. This is the section of the 990 that you're required to report it on, so you don't have to give a lot of information. And we, so we said on there, this is what's happened. Obviously, they did not know that that was wrong. Here's the calculation of the amount, and that we fix that by running through payroll. So now we have fixed it contemporaneously. Another organization working with has actually two more, I think, have a little bigger issue there. So it could be to the extent of, hey, over the years, this person's gotten $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 in benefits that have not been run through payroll. Again, you can fix that, run it through. You can either go back and rerun all your payrolls, depending on how big an issue that is, or and that's up to the board. If they feel like, hey, we at least want to fix it in the current year, you can run through a huge payroll for that person for the current year and then go back on the form and say, we've now fixed it. The good thing is, once you said you fixed it, now going forward, you can always say no to that question. Because now you say, okay, we had it in a prior year, but it's saying, have you ever had it in a prior year that has not been reported? Well, now we've reported it. The other thing I would say, this is, I guess, the way accountants think, but not necessarily the best way. The other thing I would say is right now, the IRS has been way behind because of COVID-related stuff. So if you want to fix a problem, now's a good time to do it. So is there any questions on that excess benefit transaction?
You mentioned gift cards. My attorney, his interpretation of that is a gift card is not taxable because it is not equivalent of cash. Now, cash, obviously, your Christmas bonus, that's all included in payroll. But a $10 gift card, I said, okay, can I give them a ham? Yeah, absolutely. I said, so can I give them a gift card for a ham? They can't get any cash back from that card. They'll never see cash from it. It'll only be goods. And that's our current understanding. Now, does this make a difference, employee versus executives?
No. Not from a payroll standpoint. From an excess benefits transaction standpoint, it does. But from a payroll standpoint, it would not make a difference.
So your interpretation, even a $10 Starbucks card, I have to put on that payroll?
The IRS sees gift card as cash.
Could you send me...
Sure. You want to give me your information afterwards? Yep. And we
isn't,
can...
Isn't there a dollar limit on that? I see that on forms. It's either $20 or $50. If it's over that amount, it's reportable as income.
Is that what he's saying? Do you know?
No. $10 is our standard. I mean, we hand out $10 Starbucks and Panera cards.
Well, it could be that he's saying
are you saying $20 or $50 cumulative? Or
yes,
in one shot?
Well, cumulative. I think
over
it's cumulative over a year.
Oh, well. Okay, I'm still home.
Okay. Well, we'll find out the exact, and we'll let you know.
But excess benefit would only apply to the executives.
To the executives. Right. So, and or family members of executives. So.
On the vehicle. So if we have a executive using an organizational vehicle for personal use, how's that supposed to be handled?
That would be run through payroll as well.
So their benefit, I can't quite think how the money's flowing there. What's going through payroll?
The benefit of using the car. Does anybody do that for?
We pay mileage. So if I use a vehicle for personal, I just report the mileage, and then they bill me X much a mile. I pay for that. Basically, you're getting a benefit, and so they would show that as a. It would show a $30 bonus and a $30 deduction. But basically, that 30 was there, so you paid taxes on that, even though
sure.
No money.
Okay.
Same thing with
the amount they reimbursed for personal use should be shown as payroll. we can talk about later.
It's an in and out. Same thing with a gift card. If you get a gift card, it's an in and out, and it's in your payroll. So there's no cash involved. Although, actually, like, for our organization, we've had somebody retire, and we gave them a gift card. And the way we did is we ran it through and grossed it up. So they got a little bit extra of a bonus in their payroll to help pay the taxes on the gift card.
How does covering an employee's health care costs factor into this?
It depends. It depends if it's what it is. Is it set up as a tax-free plan? Are we talking about a healthcare sharing ministry? Is it insurance or is it healthcare sharing ministry?
Sharing.
Okay, so that's not, that's straight wage. So if you.
So what I paid Anabaptist Health Share is reported as income to them.
Correct. Correct. And so the way we did it again for our organization is say the individuals on. When this new law came out, individuals on healthcare sharing ministry, we just increased their wage by that amount, and off they go, you know, pay on your own. So, but yeah, if you could set, if it's true insurance, you could set it up as a tax-free benefit, then you're good. If it's not, then you got a problem. And again, that could be an excess benefit transaction.
What if after the healthcare sharing ministry, they still have a sizable hospital bill, and we as an organization wish to help with that? Our current practice, these Mennonites that understand these things, is we just quietly make a donation to this church over there, and that deacon just happens to know we're descendant. Is this legal? Is this legit? Or is this backdoor? That we made a donation to Rosewood BG Church, and what that deacon does with it is entirely up to him.
Yes, it's somewhere between all three of those. So basically, so if you're at a church level, you can do benevolence. And as a nonprofit, you can do benevolence. So say you're helping out this person that's in need, and they're within your church community. That's fine. Say you're helping out somebody that's in need and they're within the program of structure of what you do as your nonprofit. That's fine. If you just start paying things for people, we got a problem. Because if you look at the ultimate spectrum of what the IRS doesn't want, the IRS doesn't want, all church members just give all their income to the church. It's now all tax-free. And then the church just pays their mortgage, pays their, you know, gas, their car, and all that. So that's what you're trying to escape. So I think in the situation you're in, you'd want to be careful. I think that's a good answer.
Spoken like a true accountant.
So, but I mean, if you're giving... Does it fit the program of what you do as an organization?
No.
Okay, you got to be careful just from that standpoint with doing that.
Although, yes, maybe. Relieve human suffering is one of our problems.
Who's the lawyer you use? Maybe you should talk to them. Let me take that one on board as well.
Okay.
and discuss it.
Yeah, we'll discuss
after this one. And let's figure out. Any other questions? We're about out of time.
Just wondered, church, school situations, is there any hiccups that you've seen or warnings that you want to administrator is running the school, separate checking account, but it's all under church.
And how do you pay for the Do all students pay? Do only church members go?
All students are issued a tuition tab.
Okay.
Not all students pay. They have a scholarship that can be plugged in for those that don't pay.
Okay.
But no, it isn't a members only.
Yeah. I think the big thing with a church school is just that it's set up correctly. Years and years ago, I'll try to find it. I've seen a write-up on church schools. If you'll leave me your name and email address, I'll try to get it to you. Anything else? So hopefully everybody feels very good about how they've been in compliance and have no concerns at all. Thank you for coming, and do you need to say anything else?
Thank you for listening. All recordings from Reach 2022 are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. To purchase additional recordings from Reach or other Faith Builders events, visit us online at www.christianlearning.org or call us at 814-789-4769.